Good evening, folks. Thanks so much to all of you for coming out tonight on a rainy Sunday night here in the Bay Area. We don't get many of these. I was talking to someone from Minnesota today. They were mocking us and sure that everyone would stay home for this event because it was raining. So thank you to those of you who braved the rain. I have a quick couple of logistic announcements before we get started. If you don't have a First Press parking sticker on your car, we have parking passes on the back table, and you could just stick one in your car real quick. We promise there's nothing good that's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, so you have time. but stick one on your car because we don't want you to get a ticket. And then also, unrelated to tonight, but another cool event, New College of Berkeley is a partner of ours, and they asked us to announce an event that they have coming up next week called The Call to Ministry, a vocational forum for university students. We have flyers in the back on this, and there's more information on their website, newcollegeberkeley.org. They actually have some great speakers lined up for this that are people I've met and can't recommend highly enough, and would really encourage you to go, particularly if you are an undergrad or grad student, exploring vocation and calling. If you're a panelist for this evening, you can come up and sit in any order that you would like. And as they come up, this is, I think, the second time that University Ministries and our Justice, Poverty, Oppression, and Women Initiative and Missions has co-sponsored an event like this. And the last time we did it, we just decided we have to do a lot more of this because we were so encouraged by it. But tonight's topic is a conversation that both of our ministries have been engaged in for quite some time. This topic of race, but also as it relates to the ideas like privilege and access. For us in the missions department, really practically relates here locally for the conversation our country is having nationally, the conversations that we're having as a church and knowing we're needing to have a lot more of. And then it also, the idea of privilege and race and access relates to a lot of the conversations we're having internationally. So some of you who are from First Press remember the international speakers that we've had the last couple of weeks, Dr. Casale and Dr. Cassis. And that was not intentional that their names were so close to each other, and we did mix it up a lot. And this is just, tonight's event is one more way that we want to continue this conversation, but really more close to home of how it relates to our lives here in the Bay Area and in this country. And then Ryan will come up after me and talk a bit more about how this relates to university ministries. Before Ryan comes up, I have a couple of things to share. One is that I'm especially excited about tonight's panel. We're going to have them introduce themselves. But as I look at them, each of them are people that have been really helpful and formative in my own journey in exploring this and what it means to be a white woman of privilege in the Bay Area and start to delve into these issues. And I'm just really grateful to each of them for the voices they bring. One of the panelists we advertised was Yushan Tarango Shah, and she had a health emergency today and wasn't able to be with us. And so at 2:00 this afternoon, I called Esther Cho, who is a member of our congregation. She was actually part of the early days of our J-POW team forming. She's a graduate student at Cal doing her PhD in sociology, looking at a lot of the issues we'll be talking about tonight, and couldn't be more qualified in so many ways to be talking about this. But one of the things I want to highlight, because I know she won't, is that Esther is a Harvey Fellow, which is a fellowship that is specifically for Christians who are in areas of academic research that typically aren't well represented by Christians. It's a really competitive program, and they were interested in what she had to say about this topic too. So we're so grateful that Esther was willing to step in at the last minute. The last two things I'll say is just we are wanting this to be an ongoing conversation, that these aren't one-off events that we're doing, but this is a series of conversations we're engaging in the life of our church. So November 12th, we'd love to invite you back to a conversation that the university ministry is going to be holding about mass incarceration and ways that that touches on race, and some exciting speakers that are coming in for that, which Ryan can share a little more knowledgeably about. But one of them is a chaplain in prisons who's written a book about sort of this intersection of faith, incarceration, and race. And then on December 11th, during Advent, we've invited Ben McBride to come back and preach on a Sunday morning. Those of you who weren't with us, Ben is both a pastor and an activist in our area that works a lot on issues of race, and came and spoke in June to First Press, taught a four-week class, and also spoke in our Sunday services. So without much further ado, the last thing I want to say is, as we enter this space, this is a tough conversation to have, and all of us bring with it various lenses and various anxieties. And one of the things that has been really helpful to me the last 2 months as I've entered into these conversations is to start off just thinking about a line from a song that a friend of some of ours wrote. And the song starts out with this line, "We cry out for justice but cling to our own comfort." And I think of how often I want to be engaged in the work of justice until it like really deeply impacts me personally and something that I might have to give up. And tonight I would just encourage you to, as best you can, set aside just some of those initial reactions that might come and come with a heart open to hear what our panelists have to share. I said the last thing and then I remembered one more thing. You have these cards on your seat. As the panelists talk tonight, if you have a question, write it down and pass it forward and center, and I'll be sorting them for Ryan, who's our moderator tonight, and we will get those questions asked. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Bridget. Thanks to you all again for coming out on what feels like home to me, coming from Washington State. This weekend's been gorgeous. I'm really excited about tonight's conversation, but as Bridget mentioned, also coming into it with a little bit of trepidation, actually, just realizing this is a tricky thing that we're talking about. So I appreciate you all being willing to come out for this time. Really brief introduction, and then we'll get to the panelists. If we haven't met, my name's Ryan Pemberton. I'm the Minister for University Engagement here at First Pres Berkeley. And the reason we are engaged in these conversations, as we have been in the past, on panel conversations on refugees, race, gender, and faith identity, is because these are conversations that are already happening on campus. And so in my mind, if we're not hosting these conversations in church, somehow we're not doing our job for the Christians who are university students here. So this is part of a wider conversation, we just want to say, that's already going on. As Bridget mentioned, not a one-off event. So at this point, what I'd love to do is ask you all if you'd say a brief word about who you are and maybe about the work that you're doing in the East Bay.
Buenas noches. Yo soy Miguel López, el hijo de Guillermo y Delfina López, y el papá de Leslie Arcadia. For those of you who don't speak Spanish, good evening. I'm Miguel López. I'm the son of Guillermo and Delfina López, and the father of Leslie Arcadia and Jeffrey Alejandro. And often when I'm in a professional capacity, I put myself between these two generations, the generation of my parents, my mother, and relative to this talk tonight, my mother attended an all-Latino high school and elementary school, racially segregated. My father was smart enough to figure out to drop out of school in the eighth grade because he realized that because of his race as being a brown person, education wasn't going to get him anywhere. And yet I'm an educator. And my daughter may soon be an educator, and they're here, and they're thinking about schooling. Race is a factor for us in every way that we think about it. The children's mom is of Chinese ancestry. And so I say this generational thing because I've learned notions of justice, in great part growing up in a Catholic family in which my parents modeled for me what it meant to understand our own racial identity, but also what it meant to be people of faith, and how we had to navigate that kind of circle, do that work. I can't answer the last part of the question of the work I do in the East Bay because I don't work in the East Bay, actually. I'm a faculty member down at Cal State University, Monterey Bay, where I do teacher education. I've been doing teacher education for almost 30 years in one capacity or another, but principally do a lot of work in the Salinas Public Schools, which, if you don't know, are very typical of schools in which there's a great percentage of Latinos, principally farm workers, the South salad bowl of the world, high levels of undereducation and areas in which the racial realities of being brown, being undocumented, being poor intersect in great ways and define really the kind of work that I do.
Good evening. My name is Nate Milheim. I live and work in East Oakland and have for almost 10 years now. I have a wife and three kids, 12, 9, and 7. But living and working in East Oakland has really shaped my perspective. I think a lot of what I share is out of the last 10 years of living in a place where I'm the minority and of living and learning from my neighbors and the families around me. So I work with a faith-based nonprofit called Oakland Leadership Center. So we do mentoring and developing leaders of young men and women, primarily 18 to 30 years old, some life coaching one-on-one, helping young people find jobs, get enrolled back in school. Also run some basketball leagues and a music studio to reach out to young people in East Oakland.
Hi, everyone. I'm Esther. As Bridget said, I'm a fifth-year PhD student in sociology at Berkeley, and I study the intersection of race and illegality. So my dissertation is on Asian undocumented immigrants and how racial stereotypes in this country might shape how they experience their status differently from Latino undocumented immigrants, for instance. I was born in Southern California to my parents, who came with their respective families from Korea when they were in their 20s, and went to school on the East Coast, worked there, and then came back here for grad school. And it's been really awesome being part of First Press and just living in Berkeley, and feel like being here has taught me a lot about these questions that we're trying to tackle today.
My name is Demetrius Edwards. I am pastor of the 23rd Avenue Church of God in Oakland, California. I've been there 3 years this November. Have one wife. I hope that gets approval within the room. Three children. Age ranges are kind of nutty. 23, 12, and 8. Not only do I pastor a local church, but also do a little bit of work with a couple of different organizations in the East Bay. Happen to know of the great work that's done at OLC, but also do some mentoring one-on-one at my former high school, McClymonds High School in Oakland. It's amazing because now I have nephews who are matriculating through the same school they were trying to shut down when I was attending there over 25 years ago. So not only advocate for young people in the East Bay, but just happen to be just a regular guy who people like to hang out with.
So we are operating with one mic tonight, so we'll have a little bit of a delay here, but we are getting it all recorded, so we want to make sure we're speaking in the microphone. And two comments I also want to make before I jump into the first question is the fact that we're not assuming tonight that because of the fact that we're hosting a conversation on race and privilege and this is who we've invited out, that everyone's at the table, because that's clearly not the case. We have some populations who aren't here tonight, no one of Middle Eastern descent, no native populations, and we want to acknowledge that up front. But we also want to say we're doing our best and we're starting a conversation in this context. And the other thing I want to mention, and this came out in a conversation that Bridget and Miguel and I were having this week, and about halfway through the conversation, I just sort of said, hey, look, I'm actually really uncomfortable with the fact that I'm a white male moderating the conversation on race and privilege. That feels inappropriate somehow. And yet this is my job as university minister, and so I'm stepping into that. But I just want to acknowledge that up front. And then I also, on that topic, something you said, Miguel, was really helpful for me. So I'm just going to ask you to repeat that for everyone here. Can you explain the difference between earned and unearned privilege and what difference that makes for this conversation?
Sure. If you read the ideas that are up there about privilege, we often, those of us that do racial scholarship, what's often called critical race theory, make a major distinction between what we call earned privileged and unearned privileged. And in the American context vis-a-vis race, the distinction would simply be that white folks, historically and contemporarily, have unearned privilege simply because of melanin, because of racialized features that we typically associate, a historical
precedents that have been set in law constitutionally, have been before the Supreme Court, give certain people historical privilege that is not earned in any way, shape, or form. It's just given because of sociological ways that we codify race in the U.S. The other part of it that's important for me as a person of faith is that when we come to think about ourselves in relationship to the gospel, the salvation that we receive is totally unearned. And so when we think about upsetting that notion of earned privilege and unearned privilege, I think as a person of faith, I come at that from a position of humility, knowing that I stand before the cross and the work that Jesus Christ did on my behalf. And it is only because of that that I am actually now, to play with the whole terminology, privileged to even speak of the gospel. And I think if we take that sense of humility in which we begin as folks of faith with that basis, it might help us, as Bridget was asking us to do, to put aside some of those initial potential racialized and sociological kinds of ways that we look at the world and come at that common angle of being saved by grace, grace alone. We can get into a large theological discussion about that, but that's the challenge for me as I think about unearned privilege and unearned grace. They go hand in hand.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Miguel. That's helpful for me again to hear, so I appreciate you walking through that. The first question that I want to ask the panel as a whole, and you're welcome to take it as you see fit, I think there is a certain tendency to think of white people as a sort of neutral on the topic of race. There can be a tendency to think that's a their problem issue. Can we speak a little bit about why that's problematic? Why is race something that we all deal with and not just certain populations?
Okay, we're just gonna go this way. So I'm gonna actually try and answer it both ways, that race is not a their problem or an our problem, but it's a we problem. And then I'm actually going to answer it as a we problem and a their problem, because I'm gonna actually argue that as folks of color, and I'm just gonna include myself in that category, I come at the issue of racism in the United States radically differently than my colleagues who are white. And that's just simply the history and the ways in which race gets worked out. So I start this off with a notion in which, right, in the Gospels, we hear this notion that in Jesus, right, there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, et cetera, et cetera. And in that sense, we're all beloved by Christ. And we all exist in a fallen world in which the fallenness is part of all of our collective responsibility to wrestle with. And thus racism, whether we want to call that, quote, the original sin or not, at least in terms of American, I've got some problems with that as well as loving it for a sense, requires us then to think about God's work here on earth, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, of creating that redemptive sense of God's kingdom here. And racism, and thus the elimination of that, is a we problem. It's a we problem in which we get the chance to be able to extend the grace of God to each other and think about that as our work in very real ways in which racism exists. I do want to say, though, that I think it is an our problem and a their problem. I think that as a person of color, the ways in which I understand my own racial identity, the ways in which I am racialized for good or for bad, and let me just give you a typical one in which that comes off. I am often, quote, the angry Latino. Because I question things. I challenge traditional ways of understanding race. Because unfortunately, I have experience of being racialized. There are cities in which I have not been able to get a cab. There are ways in which, because of my racial identity, I've been asked to hang up coats in an award-winning banquet when I'm getting the most prestigious award. These are the everyday realities of being racialized in America. And so it is my problem in terms of how I respond to that with grace. But this one evening when I was getting this award and I was asked to put up a coat by three different white women, and after I said to the woman, well, I wouldn't be able to give you the ticket for your coat because I'm here to receive this award. And for the next 20 minutes, she followed me around the room because she was full of embarrassment. And that, I want to suggest, became her problem. It interacted with me, but her own sense of guilt and the racial obligation that got worked out in that moment. After I said, I'm cool, I'm just here to enjoy the evening, she continued to wrestle with it. And that's where I think there has to be both and, our problem, their problem, but at some point in time, the individual responsibility as we extend love and grace to each other needs to work that out.
Thank you. I'm going to answer this in two ways. One of them, I'm reminded of Martin Luther King's work and quotes. He had a way with words that I wish I could have a tiny bit of the way he had with words. But he talked about in their work for freedom and for justice, he was doing it for the oppressed and for the oppressor, that both needed to be set free from that system. So I think we are all interconnected, and as we're working for one, we are working for all of us to find that freedom together. The other thing, this is related to not directly answering the question, but one of the things that I've been reflecting on a lot lately is, and it happens on social media, which is a whole other topic, right, of how that goes right now in America. But in the press, social media, where I see a person of color pointing out an injustice, whether it's a personal incident or a reality in America, and then I see other people of color validating that, and white people saying nothing or saying, no, you're wrong. And this happens a fair amount of the time in our reality, either personally or on social media. And every time I see that, it grieves me. It makes me angry, it makes me sad, that so many of us who have this white privilege can either ignore the discussion or say, oh, I think you're probably wrong, right? And to see it unfold that way, people of color saying, this is happening, and white people saying, no, it's not happening, or I'm going to ignore it, just it really grieves me, really grieves me.
I think to add to all the wonderful things that have been said already, I think it's a white person problem because that's who holds the power. What comes with privilege is the idea of power, and unfortunately, there is this unearned power and privilege that comes with skin color. And so with that access to systems of power that exist in this society, that is where change could really start and where it could actually be effective. And it is, like Miguel said, a problem that exists within all of us because we need to wrestle with the ways that we are individually racialized and collectively racialized. I think that's something that I've had to learn just growing up in this country and having privileges as an Asian person in a very heavily Asian context and then moving to different contexts where I did not have a lot of co-ethnic, co-racial peers and navigating what it means to be in these different racialized spaces. And so in that way, there has to be introspection and acknowledgement that this is a reality that exists for all of us, but in different ways, in different spaces.
Complex question, very complex answer, because we have to understand that everyone isn't going to come from a place of faith. So race sometimes, even within our religious circles, within our houses of faith, it becomes a magnified problem because we know that in our houses of faith, usually the most segregated time during week is on a Sunday morning. So it is a collective problem where it's their problem and our problem because once again, the responsibility of how you respond to privilege has to be measured in a way, especially when, and I share this all the time, no more in my life am I aware that I am a big black man? And that in itself carries its own weight because oftentimes big black man does not connect with preacher, pastor, Christian. Sometimes my race detaches me from the identity of faith. But as a person of faith, I always carry the complexity of all those realities crashing at one intersection. So the Christian me has to respond by saying, forgive and love and help and heal. But then part of my racial identity is conflicted because not only do I recognize privilege, but I also realize that I have privilege myself that I have to sometimes remember. This past year was probably one of the most eye-opening experiences in my life. Growing up in Oakland, I was privileged to grow up around different ethnicities. In the late 70s, early 80s, there was a heavy influx of Cambodian communities who were coming to Oakland, but also had a chance to grow up with a Native family. And not until this summer, having an opportunity to go to East St. Louis, Illinois, to go out to the Cahokia Mounds, did I realize that privilege in this country doesn't start and pivot with slavery, but the erasure of the entire story of natives who were here at least over 1,000 years ago. So I realized that I also have privilege in ignoring the pain and the agony of those who are natives, but also wanting someone to pay attention to my own pain and story of my own privilege, not realizing that I'm overlooking another group of people who, if I take time to identify with their pain and realize that I have privilege, that that person does not have privilege, and that there needs to be a connection of me not only saying there is privilege for one group, but also realizing that I have privilege myself, that I need to learn how to connect the story of my own personal pain, the story of my racial pain, with other people groups, and not overlooking their stories as well.
Thank you. And yes, awkward pause. But thank you for each of your responses. Those were really helpful. And I feel like you've already sort of touched on the next question I want to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyways, just in case there's anything else that might come up. What I'm curious about are, what are some of the challenges that racial privilege itself might present for us talking on race, racism, specifically in ways that maybe we're blind to, if you can flesh those out a little bit. And can we overcome those, actually? Does that make sense?
All right. The way that I want to kind of talk about, quote, the problem of racial privilege is really just the simple idea of observing that it's there. And I think one of the ways in which that's a challenge for me in my particular vocation is that we move beyond the N-word. We move beyond the kind of over-the-top Ku Klux Klanish realization, but we begin to look at what one educator, Joyce King, out of Santa Clara, calls disconscious racism, the ways in which we are not intentionally trying to be consciously racist, but the ways in which, by the very nature of how we've been raised, socialized, especially within communities of faith, blind us to everyday realities. So let me just talk real briefly and just throw a couple of statistics, not that I believe that statistics convince us anything, but I think they speak to the starkness. In the field of K-12 education where I work, we are now more racially segregated than we were in 1954 at Brown v. Board of Education. So we all think with Brown, it's all good. It's not good. The vast majority, roughly about 80% of all black and brown youth in the United States, attend what are called majority-minority schools, in which 85% or greater of all of their co-peers are of the same racial group, or if they're not black, they're brown, one of those. So the idea that post-Brown we've dealt with race clearly isn't the reality. Now, when you put that against class, and you put that against poverty, and you put that against a whole variety of ways in which education, both outside of the Christendom, right, in the sense of this is the grand equalizer within a democracy, civic engagement, and those kinds of things, I think it's a field in which it's easy to look past and not think about the ways in which race continues to have its presence, and I would argue, most importantly, a disproportionately negative impact upon communities of color. And so I think when I look beyond the individual racism and begin to talk about notions of power and systemic power and institutional power, I think K-12 education is one of those realms that if we sit and talk about what does it look like to create change and equity and justice, what would our Lord want us to be doing? That I think that's a difficult question and challenge for us. I think as a church, we've wrestled with that vis-a-vis Faith Network. We've wrestled with it in terms of some of the days of doing justice. And I think that's a beginning great point to the conversation. But I think that there are great ways in which we can continue to look at. I would say to a certain extent, I don't know your work that well, but just what I read about it, if we were doing schools well, you'd be out of a job almost, right? And you would be studying the whole realm of sociology of undocumentedness in a radically different way. And so those are just some ways in which these things are interconnected.
Thanks. I'll be brief. I'm going to speak as a white man, which I am. but one of the things that makes this conversation difficult, and I think can derail it, you know, I think for me, I remember at some point in time hearing words like white privilege, and then words like white supremacy, mm-hmm. And then words like a history of oppression, racial oppression in the United States, then hearing a word like reparations. Mm-hmm. And when I first heard those words, I felt very defensive, very awkward, very a little afraid, ashamed, and probably mostly defensive. And I think I've had that reality in talking to family, to friends, where we start a conversation, and I can feel a certain word or phrase that triggers huge amounts of defensiveness, and then even stories. You don't understand what happened to me at this point in time. So, I mean, I've literally read, you know, messages from family members. You don't understand what I've been through, nephew. You don't understand. It's been hard. I'm not saying it wasn't hard, but I'm saying there's a reality of white privilege in America. So I think for a lot of us, we have to find a way to push through this defensiveness that some of us can get and find a way to push through it to where we can have an honest discussion and learn in a humble way. And that might take really taking a lot of time to read, to study, to reflect until some of those words become more natural and normal to us as we get there. But I think we have to push through that defensiveness as white people.
I think one challenge that comes up for me is that it's very easy for us to have an us versus them mentality and pit different racial groups against one another. And that's definitely one of the challenges of racial privilege. With privilege comes power and access, and that could also mean that you, like, one group might think of themselves against another group or above another group or under, et cetera. And that is not a helpful way of thinking about it. So I think this reframe, especially as a faith community, that we're all made in the image of God, that this is not the way that God intended our society to be like, I think is helpful, because I think there is this very natural but also institutionally kind of motivated way of creating boundaries between groups. And I think when we talk about privilege, it's really, really hard to not go there, kind of like what you were saying. But instead, having conversations and dialogue in order to break those boundaries and see more of the unifying factors while also balancing that with what are the privileges that I have and how does that actually contribute to the oppression of another group.
I think one of the obvious things about privilege is that when you are not a part of the privileged group, you never have the opt-out button. So I never have the opt-out of what the majority has agreed about the minority. To give you an example, if there were 20 people in a room and 18 were of the same race, there really is no need for the 18 to come together and decide how do we include the two, because you have the power and the privilege to continue to lock the two out. So the issue now becomes the willingness of letting go of privilege, because the honest truth is no one wants to give up privilege, no matter what that privilege may be. If you were in a position where you had the advantage, you would probably be more invested in maintaining or enhancing that advantage, because it makes it easier for you to maintain a place of power, a place of control. But now I ask the question in a sense to how does that intersect with faith? Because if we were to look at this from a perspective, let's say, of the first century church, how they were not satisfied until they all had everything in common. And a part of your faith should wrestle with you as you see things that are not equal. It should cause you to wrestle with your own privilege. And I would ask each individual in your own personal time, in your own personal reflection, ask the Lord to point out in ways that you benefit from privilege. And then how can you go about undoing the way that you benefit from privilege? I'll give you a great insight on a conversation. A few days ago, a guy asked me about the SBC some years ago, a few years ago, putting out a statement of some of the things that they may have co-opted as far as racial inequality within the SBC church. And he says, what do you think about the statement? Well, I said, well, the statement itself is good, but if there's no corresponding action with this statement or this apology, then really the words mean nothing because there has been no effort, there has been no investment in undoing what privilege has, you know, has done for the SBC church. So a conversation alone without action really is not a challenge to privilege. Privilege only gets challenged when there are steps taken to dismantle systems of privilege that allows everyone to have an equal share at the table.
Thank you again for each of those responses. Very helpful. I have follow-up questions I want to ask. I'm going to table those because we have other questions, and also I want to give space to you all also to be putting your questions in as well, so I might follow up later with some of you. And the next question, to be perfectly honest, I'm tempted not to ask because it's so big. I feel like we could have an entire evening just on this question alone, but also I would feel like we were just missing an incredible opportunity not to talk about this. So the question I want to ask is, given where we are at as a country, given where our media is at as a country, how is racial privilege tied to how we might view police? And we can even extend this question, I think, to the law in general, to schools, to banking, and maybe other systems. But how is racial privilege tied to how we might view our relationship with those systems?
I'm just going to show up next week with my Netflix account. We're just going to watch the 13th. For those of you who know that, right? For those of you who don't know, it's a Netflix original. Go get an account. It's worth watching just in terms of whether you agree or disagree with the message, just the ways in which the folks who put that together have tried to lay out an argument. And again, the point isn't so much whether you, it's called the 13th. It's a single one. It's reference to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, save for criminals. And so that's why we have the chain gangs. That's why we continue to have a prison industrial system, right? So besides coming out and watching the 13th and then having us a discussion, we'll all come back, yes. I think if you listen to that argument that's there, and it includes Bryan Stevenson, who some of you went and saw the other day at UC Berkeley, and if you haven't read his book, again, another thing to do. But I think that one of the arguments that they make in that, and I think this is going to be my attempt to come back and say, how do we view the police, is I'm going to flip the script. I'm trying not to be too overly critical of the police and law enforcement. I do want to begin with the notion that the police are here to, quote, serve and protect, and often serve and protect our communities. That's the basis with which I begin, and in a sense, for me as a person of faith, that's where I would love to be able to see them and as I pray for them. But having said that, if you watched the news recently in which there was a young gentleman who was killed, and the police helicopter, which the gentleman in the police helicopter looked down at an African-American man on the ground and said, that must be some bad dude, some dangerous person. And I think that one of the challenges of race in America, and if you listen to the 13th argument, is not only do we look at black and brown bodies as criminals, individuals who commit crimes, but we look at them as criminal, as personas, as a character, almost as a cultural trait. And so when we begin with that kind of premise, as I would argue was articulated by that kind of a comment, then the notion in which a police officer must shoot first so as to protect her or himself, that shooting, asking questions later, kind of almost presupposition, is a little easier to do when you see the other, the black and brown, as the criminal. And I don't think this is very far off of the Good Samaritan story in terms of the ways in which Jesus questions. So which one was it? Right? And I think we could put any of ourselves into that scenario and ask, which one am I more like? Which one did the good deed in the right way in terms of understanding the gospel? And so I raise that in the sense of saying, when the larger culture of the society and the ways in which systems of interaction, police, not as individuals, but as departments, as a culture, that's where I would argue we have our biggest challenge, not an individual policeman, but a culture of law enforcement as opposed to community protection and service. And that's going to require a major reorientation of the ways in which we think. And it certainly is an area in which I have not been anywhere consistent in terms of prayer that I need to be. As I go in and out of these communities, that is one of those areas where I'm constantly reminded, you're not even praying sufficiently, Miguel. So as to be critiquing this, come on.
This idea that our racial privilege is tied to how we view the police systems is very real and emotional and raw for me right now due to some experiences the last 6 months or so. So for years, I've spent a lot of time with young black men who have told me stories of how they're treated versus how I'm treated. Painful stories for me to hear. Week after week for year and year and year. And I thought I had been listening and hearing. Right? I thought I had been listening and trying to be in solidarity and understanding. And then something happened just a little while ago. I'll try to tell it briefly. But a couple young men came to meet with me. I ended up having lunch with two other young men, came back to the spot where I work, and two young men were being arrested who had come to meet with me. I went into the scene and asked what was going on. And an officer jumped into my face. Very aggressive and very rude and very verbally abusive, angry way, and told me off a little bit. I was shocked. I mean, I had never been spoken to by a police officer like that in my entire life. The young men were shocked. They had never seen a police officer talk to a white man like that in their whole life. They were falling down laughing. They couldn't believe he talked to Nate like that. So this thing happens, and so I was very upset. About how these young men were treated, very upset about seeing something that I thought was unjust due to who they were, how they looked. But I think as I reflected on that, what caused me a lot of shame was that I finally felt what these young men had been saying, and even seeing it in front of me, I still thought I felt it, but it wasn't until he jumped in my face, and he talked to me that way because I was with four young black men. I was with them, and I was with them. I appeared to be their friend. That's why he spoke to me. And later another officer said, well, he just saw you with them. That's why he can talk to you that way. He didn't know you were Nate who knows city council. He didn't know you were that Nate. He just saw you with young black men, so that was kind of okay. But all that to say, what I feel ashamed about of that whole scenario is that it didn't hit me. I didn't feel it for these guys after 9 years until someone talked to me that way with them, and then I finally felt it. And the guy said, they said, Nate, that's how we get talked to every time. We've been telling you that for a long time. Now you get it. Now you know what it's to be spoken to that way because you were with us that day. So I'm still wrestling with that reality. And with the reality that I'm becoming friends with a white police officer in Oakland who is a man of faith, who I trust and care about, and is wrestling with all of this too in a deep way. But it is completely tied. And I could tell you stories for the next couple days straight of young men who have been treated a certain way because of how they look. It happens every single day over and over and over. So I'll just stop there.
I think the best way to address this very difficult question is to share a story that I heard through one of my interviews that I did with a Korean undocumented girl. And I asked them questions about their interactions with law enforcement, and she was telling me about driving through Arizona with her Latinx friend, who's actually a citizen, but she was like, but then the way that they were treated, the checkpoint officer was definitely targeting her friend and not her. And she was very sure that it was because of race. And so I feel like that's a very illuminating story that shows that we criminalize people based on their race, but also their legal status. And there's these conflations that also happen with race and class and legal status, et cetera. And I think also as an Asian American female, I'm still wrestling with, like you said, just how to how to most effectively and humbly address what is going on right now. And I've been empowered with just what the Asian American community has been doing in their response with Black Lives Matter and the letters that have been written, translated for parents to read, et cetera, so that we can harness our communities with everything. But yeah, it's hard. I don't really have a good answer to your question.
Would you just tell more about that Twitter movement on Asian looking at Black Lives Matter?
Sure. Just a few months ago, just Asian communities from all over, even Canada, started this Google Doc with a very simple letter in English that was translated into hundreds of different Asian languages, I think even beyond, right? Like other languages as well, a letter to their parents so that our first generation parents would also be informed and be able to engage with us in the movement.
I think one of the complexities of kind of deal with media, police. I think the first is that every time there is a suspect of color, no matter what the background, no matter what the case, there's always this weight of demonizing the individual on an intentional basis. I'll give you an example. 2 years ago, actually just last year, last November, I had an opportunity to speak with Lucia McMath, who is the mother of Jordan Davis. He was a young man in Florida who was shot while sitting in his car because of loud music. And we had an opportunity to watch 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets, which is the documentary about the court case. And there was something interesting that began to happen as they took time to interview Jordan's friends at a basketball court. And just asked them about what their life is like. And they're like, man, look, we're from this middle class neighborhood. We hang out, you know, we play basketball, and we pretty much don't do anything except just go to school, come home and play basketball. But there was this narrative, even in showing some of the press coverage, of trying to paint Jordan Davis having a criminal type profile, as if to justify his death, like saying he deserved to die because of the type of person that he was. And I've noticed in every high-profile case, it's pretty much been the same playbook. Trayvon Martin is labeled a thug. Mike Brown is called a monster. Tamir Rice, he's an out-of-control young man with a gun. In a sense, the media paints this narrative to take empathy and sympathy away from the loss of life or from someone being harmed in a way that makes them less than human. So the first thing I noticed in media is that there is the dehumanization of people of color, always trying to go back and find what did the person do, what they had to do something to deserve the outcome. Then the second part of this is, and this is, I didn't mention this in the beginning of my introduction, I also work with a group called the Empower Initiative. And this past year, I've had the opportunity to do procedural justice training with a few police departments. And we talk about the historical that exists within policing. We talk about how the history of policing starts immediately after slavery, how we talk about slave patrols and vagrancy laws and how those things were used to put people of color back in areas to work for free. If you think about the history of policing and the way policing looks now, there really is no difference. And we have to ask ourselves, what does a fair public safety system look like? And if the history says we are targeting this specific group, if the target doesn't change, the purpose doesn't change. And if the purpose doesn't change, who is the person who comes out on the end of suffering behind the purpose of policing is those who were the initial target who are actually classified as criminals. And so it is an amazing
thing to see in a room where you have 100 police officers. And let me just paint this picture. Santa Monica doesn't have the issues that most of our, you know, major urban centers have. In Berkeley, there's been an uptick of police-involved shootings and even community shootings. So I don't want to, you know, bring Berkeley into it. That can be very sensitive. But to look at Santa Monica, they talk about how there is this disdain for the homeless, that they become an inconvenience, that, you know, if they're hanging around the promenade, that it hurts local business. And so sometimes not even race, but your economic situation can cause you to be a target. And what I'm saying is there is little to no empathy for certain type people in our society. If you are minority, there's less sympathy. If you are what they would typify as a welfare queen, there's low empathy. If you are homeless, low empathy. And what we have to learn to do is to see each individual, no matter what the color, no matter the story, see everyone as human, because then it allows me to connect with you on a human level. And as far as police relations go, this is something that is very interesting. Police suicides are at an all-time high. An all-time high. One of the saddest stories that I've ever heard, it was a police officer in Oakland responding to a young lady by the name of Alicia Carradine, who was shot through a screen door. She is shot. He is literally now holding the young girl in his arms. She is taking her last breath, realizing that life is leaving her. Do you realize that that same officer has a daughter who is the same age? And now he is asked to go respond to the very next call. So think of the kind of system that is already high pressure, low support, high rate of suicide, high level of danger, and there's low empathy for police. Because you look at how much they get paid, you look at how much they rack up in overtime, and then there's really no sympathy for them. So they basically have no ally. And so it actually further reinforces the blue line, because they feel that they have to protect one another. And so when you have high rate of suicide, low empathy from the community, and then they feel like they're isolated amongst themselves. So they almost, in a sense, are trapped inside of a system that they don't have the tools to dismantle. And so what they do is they continue to build a system that protects themselves. And I want to follow up on something that was mentioned earlier about Terrence Crutcher, the gentleman who was shot. They, from the helicopter, they said he was a big, bad dude. The realization of how media plays into that, now we're in another election cycle. A few days ago, we were watching some clips of the 1984 election. And just thinking back to the Horton ads, how Willie Horton was used as a symbol of danger of what happens when we don't have tough policing. And it's amazing that they flashed a picture of a black man, almost in a sense to say, this is crime personified. Anyone that looks like him cannot be trusted. And that's a weight that, as a minority, I have to always walk around with the sense is that I'm always being profiled as a criminal, because it's being programmed into people's minds that I may be somebody who can inflict harm or danger.
If I could add a quick little thing. Jennifer Eberhardt, if you're interested in this whole idea of policing and race and bias, Jennifer Eberhardt is from Stanford, has a lot of research out there that's really important. Also did a lot of work in Oakland with OPD, and I was able to talk to her and interview about some of her research. But really important stuff if you're interested. She has YouTube videos and a lot of research online. Jennifer Eberhardt from Stanford.
Great. Thank you. If you have questions, please feel free to pass them along to the sort of folks on the outside edges, and then we can just pass those up to the front, and we'll make sure we get to those. But feel free to keep those coming forward. We'll jump into those questions now. I have a few more questions I'd like to ask, but I'll go ahead and start taking some of these because we have some great questions coming in. One of the first ones I want to invite you all to respond to is this. Over 82% of American teachers are white. As a white teacher, I have seen intense inherent bias in how teachers treat kids of different racial backgrounds. But it's very hard for us to admit we have any bias. How do we realize our bias and combat it?
I worked 5 years ago with a group of 9 white women who had been students of mine. It took us 2.5 years to unpack white privilege. And these were women who wanted to unpack white privilege. I don't know, other than just we met twice a month for about 4 hours a night for about 2.5 years. I will say this before I answer what we did. One of the marriages ended because her spouse didn't want to undo some of the white privilege and white supremacy that was in their relationship. 2 other women decided that if they were going to remain in the field, they had to move to different locations because they had to be outside of the realm of where their families would be because they couldn't handle the ongoing discussions with family members. That is to say, it was a real cost to doing it. There was a real cost to doing it. The easy answer for me, which is not easy at all, is I think many of the issues and topics that we've put on the table are the ones that just need to be unpacked over a long period of time with consistent community. When the 9 women who were all in different sections of mine, you know, one of the great things about being a professor is I have a one-on-one conversation with this one and a one-on-one with this one and a one-on-one with this one. And I hear the individual grief and challenge and guilt and all of those things that come with what another person calls white fragility, another term to put on your I feel bad about list. And I finally said to the 9, it's like, trust me, I'm hearing all these stories together. Let's sit down and do this work together. A lot of tears, but a lot of serious engagement, in great part because they did fundamentally believe at the end of the day that K-12 education was the place in which they believed they could make a change in society. Only one of the folks in my group was a woman of faith, and we had additional times of prayer. And so I used kind of my civic engagement democracy approach, since faith wasn't the common terminology that we could use. And I think for those of us who work in the public schools and in the public arena, how do we integrate faith and democracy, I think is an additional question that we have to wrestle with. But the beautiful thing was that what it required was this consistent part of community. None of the 9 were willing to do it by themselves. They were willing to do it if there were 8 others. And I think that there's something genuine that we take out of that, whether we're reading, you know, Life Together by Bonhoeffer, whether we're thinking about the early churches you are articulating, right? That sense of Christian community, even if I'm not going to call it that when I was working with this woman, was certainly the ethos that I was bringing to the table every time I was having a discussion with them. I would say whoever asked that question, come up and talk. You can come down and work with me. We'll do this work together.
Yeah, no easy answer. I think you answered it well, though. No easy answer. I would say, obviously, we have to first acknowledge that implicit bias is real, right? So this person obviously has. But I think for all, maybe some teachers haven't, and some of us haven't. So starting with that, really facing implicit bias is very, very real. Research proves that it's very real. And then I would say, I would echo what you said. It takes a lot of long, hard work in community to keep learning. And I think for me, I'm learning that I have to keep learning. And not to feel like you're at a point, oh, I've studied this for a couple of years. Oh, I get this, right? And I think we can all get to that point. I know as a white man, I've been studying this for a while. I have friends, you know. Meech is my friend over there, right? Like, I get all this stuff, right? And I have to get back to, no, I am still have so much to learn, and I have implicit bias that I haven't seen. So quick example relating to actually coaching, not teaching, but I was in Ferguson with Pastor Demetrius here and many others. Having long, deep wrestlings talking about race and privilege and bias. And I was really just reflecting, you know, in community, reflecting. And in that reflecting, it all of a sudden hit me. I don't know where it came from. I coach AAU teams. We have tryouts. So it's very competitive youth basketball. We have tryouts. And it suddenly hit me. I don't know why, just in this reflection mode, I think I don't judge in tryouts Asian Americans very well. I think I have a bias against Asian American basketball players, even though I'd say I love them all. And I think I overrate African American basketball players, and I probably rate white basketball players pretty even. And just in the source of this, you know, being with people talking about it, all of a sudden hit me, oh my goodness, I'm completely unfair to the Asian American players who try out. As I give them low ratings, and then they're some of my best players as I see them. But this is just an example of, like, we have to keep pushing in year after year, and we're going to keep finding things that we didn't see in ourselves the year before.
One thing that I learned from Unlikely Advocates, I think a lot of us here were there, a Project Peace event a few months ago, was, I don't remember who said it, but she said, advocacy is a spiritual discipline. And that really stuck with me. And I think that's just, I feel like there are a lot of wonderful things that have already been said, but that's what I would add, just that I think it is a lifelong discipline, something that we need to be prayerful about and introspective and reflective and really repent for how we are biased in overt and covert ways. Biases also and discrimination look differently for different people and different groups. I think one thing that's very interesting to me is that a lot of discrimination studies are still designed based on how black people are discriminated against, for instance. And so they're not really a great measure in how Latinos or how Asians, et cetera, are discriminated because there's different stereotypes that are attached to these other racial groups. And so that's another thing that I would add with everybody, not just with teachers. I think being very mindful of what we bring to interactions and also seeing those people as individuals, those students as individuals, instead of the color of their skin, et cetera, which is, yeah, a spiritual discipline. And so that's something that I'm trying to work on and be mindful of as well.
I think awareness is always the first step to solving anything. Very interesting, because this past week, my daughter actually attends school here in Berkeley, an elementary school. She's at Thousand Oaks on Solano and Colusa. And just this past week, my wife and I facilitated a meeting with other parents who, what we're going to say, minority parents on campus. There was something I did not realize until the Thursday meeting, until it was brought up, that there is around 10% of the student population is African-American. There's a heavy Hispanic population, and there is a small fraction of Asian-American students who attend the school. But of the faculty, there is not one person of color who is an actual school teacher. And so the principal, who actually happens to be Caucasian, had asked the question, how can we be aware of bias as far as the school, how it treats minorities? And then how does that carry over to your children in there when they go home? And so one of the things that I would say is that seeking to make improvement is always great. And it depends on how the bias actually plays out. One of the things that I have to ask, having daughters who actually both attended the school, I have to acknowledge there is a difference and how young girls of color are treated and how young boys of color are treated. And there is a definite dividing line. I have a nephew who was said to be ADHD. The problem is he is just literally bored. They're now talking about skipping him almost three grades because he was misdiagnosed because he was so just hyper in class, because the stuff they were giving him was far beyond his, you know, far below his comprehension and his ability level. And so sometimes the bias is not really in the classroom from a teacher. Sometimes it's the actual school system or the administrative staff of the school. And I think teachers are sometimes real hesitant. I think a lot of times teachers do tend to try to be even in how they treat their children, because it's also a reflection on how they even deal with a parent. So I think the bias is more along administrative lines and how schools approach different issues. But for in the classroom, I would say try to build a relationship that allows you to get to know that child to help the bias, you know, to get past that or over the bias.
So So this is a question actually we had hoped to ask up front, but I feel like it's such a good fit. I want to ask it as a bit of a follow-up question. Several of you talked about community. We learn about implicit bias and how to overcome it in community. We need one another to do this work. I love that. Thank you. And yet, how do we avoid sort of making the burden of my learning become a weight that you need to carry so that I'm not tripping up over myself?
Just leave me alone. You know, I'm going to play both of these arguments. I get exhausted. And it's like, I'll just use you, Ryan. Just seriously, leave me alone enough already. Would you just go hang out with Nate for a while and you guys just work on your white together? Because I'm exhausted. In the literature, we call it a cultural tax that is put on folks of color, in the same way that women hold a cultural tax on dealing with issues of sexism and gender oppression. It's exhausting. I'm always asked to do the race card, right? Talk to us about race, Miguel. Talk to us about race again. Talk to us about race. It's like, I don't need to talk about race. I got this thing down, right? And yet simultaneously, the gospel says, what does it mean to love my neighbor? Shoot, my neighbor's white. I don't get a choice there. And I have many arguments with many of my colleagues of color who don't come out of a tradition of faith. And they're like, enough already. I'm not going to do it anymore. And I'm going to say, okay, that's cool. That's your choice to do. I got this other thing that keeps calling at me. Because it's not, going back to your earlier question, a them problem or an our problem. If I continue to kind of say, Nate, just deal with it on your own, then it's your problem. And I haven't seen you in the light of Jesus. I haven't seen you as a broken person who seeks healing. And I haven't believed that your healing can only come about in part because I'm ministering to you. And that part of my healing with when I'm tired of it is because you're going to be there in some way to say, all right, let's figure this out. Now, having said that, I am going to say that there are times when folks of color, we just need to be in the room together as folks of color. I mentor a group of 30 Latinas, Mexicanas down in Salinas. No white folks allowed. Why? Because we don't want to have to be articulating to everybody else in the group, one or two other folks, why we believe in what we believe. We just want to start from a point of being able, this is an accepted belief and understanding of our cultural identity, and we need to grow in that rather than being defensive about it, rather than trying to deconstruct it for everybody else in the room. And there are times when I fundamentally believe that white folks just need to be in the own room. Call that stuff whatever you want to call that, because I don't want to hear white guilt out of you anymore, because that just takes you back to you, right? And then there has to be times in which we're bringing those two groups together intentionally and explicitly, as you were articulating earlier, with this great sense of humility to have the interracial dialogue, right? Now, I'm just going to reframe this Virginia v. Loving, 1967. It wasn't that long ago that the Supreme Court said it was okay for a black man to marry a non-black woman. And so if we just think about Virginia v. Loving as not that long ago, then the challenges that we as a faith community or we as a nation have on trying to do this interracial stuff, it shouldn't surprise us that we're really bad at it. I think if we had another person on the Supreme Court, they could just sit us down and say, now talk it out, right? We need that almost instructive kind of a thing. It's fatiguing. And so I'm just going to say this from a very selfish kind of personal sense. I just need you to know that sometimes and just leave me alone. And other times I need you to come up to me and say, you just look fatigued. Is it because you've been carrying the proverbial banner again? And I need to be ministered to in that moment because I don't want to keep dealing with this, right? And then the other part that I'll put out is this, is that, and I want to come back to the Asian American response to the Black Lives Matter, because I think it was beautiful in the way in which another community said, A, we know that our parents' generation is much more conservative and has a racial antagonism towards black folk. And we, the younger Asian American community, want to challenge our own parents on that, but we feel really awkward about that, right? And so I think that's one of those areas also where I want to say that if we can learn from other communities of color, as folks of color, we need to do that well. So it doesn't become white versus folks of color, but as you were arguing earlier, Esther, that we're really in community with each other as we're wrestling with this, because we haven't figured it out either, right? And I'm just going to add this one last thing, because it's often part of the earlier question about how we see the police, and it's part of the blue kind of Lives Matter response. And that's this argument of black-on-brown violence and brown-on-brown violence and black-on-black violence. Statistically, I don't need to, as a brown person, fear whites. If I look at the statistics, I need to fear another brown person. And I need to fear another black person, right? And I don't mean that, and I'm not saying that sarcastically. I'm actually saying that sincerely in terms of the communities in which I work in. It doesn't mean the other truth is not true. Both of those truths can be true at the same time. But it means that not only does there need to be the interracial work, but there needs to be the black-brown work. There needs to be the brown-brown work. There needs to be the brown-yellow work. That needs to be done radically as part of that larger way. Because until we break down the black-white dichotomy that America lives in, there's not going to be space for these other voices that need to be part of the larger racial healing that needs to take place.
Thanks. I think us white people need to be okay with just talking to white people sometimes. That's okay. And I think I've felt that in the past. Oh, for this conversation to be real, there has to be people of color in our conversation, or it doesn't feel real to me. Like, we can't talk about race without you there with me. I feel bad about it. Like, I feel like it's not good enough. So just as a quick story. So my buddy Chris is sitting back there, and so he's a part of a community, and I went and visited this community like 8 years ago, mostly white community, and I'm doing my work in East Oakland, and I'm thinking initially I don't want to hang out with this many white people in a small community. Like, that feels weird to me. My whole life is in East Oakland, so I had that lens, right? And then ended up saying, but you know what, these wonderful people who are mostly very white, they're welcoming me in. And we have had these amazing discussions for several years of pushing very deeply into race and privilege with a lot of white people at the table, and pushing in at reading together, watching things together, having hard discussions together about how we're all navigating this. And it's been a beautiful learning thing for me. But I think that's okay. So I think, like, Bridget and Ryan and Pastor Demetrius and I were in a clergy cohort together, mostly led by black leaders, pastors, which was great. But then there was a point in time where there was a white caucus that met, and a couple of us felt really weird about it. Like, can we do this? should we do this? Like, did someone ask Ben if it's okay if we have a white caucus? I don't. But we had it. Partly we needed to have our own conversation. We needed to say, how are we feeling with the intense thing we've had in this multiracial space? How are we doing with it? Because we are all facing this from our white background and how we're viewing it, and we need to talk about this with us. How are we doing with it? And that's okay. I think we have to give ourselves permission. And I think anytime that a person of color does share a story with us, we should be deeply grateful. I think I take it for granted too often. When a person of color tells me a personal story, it's too easy to take for granted. I should be deeply, deeply grateful that someone would share their story with me. And I would say, in closing, we're in the information age. So, I mean, you mentioned the movie The 13th. I mean, there are books and documentaries and articles out there for us. If we want to learn, I mean, you can read Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, right? You can read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. You can read The House I Live In. I mean, if you don't even want to read, you can just watch documentaries. Yeah. Right? And learn so much. So I think we can do a lot of learning on our own.
I think to add to that, just for me personally, I grew up in a very Asian-heavy community. And so a lot of my friends ended up being Asian-American until actually coming to Berkeley. The last 5 years is when I really started having very close friends of a different race. And this is also where I realized that I very much implicitly distance myself from white people more than from other people of color. I feel safer with other people of color, regardless of whether they're Asian or not. And so it was very interesting to me, because I didn't know that, because I never had to confront it. And so I think, just on a personal level, what I would say is building relationships with people who are different from us, who are non-white, if you're white, and vice versa. Like, for me as an Asian person, I had the opportunity to get close to other people of color in my department, for instance, and because it's a sociology department, I was able to talk more openly about race and privilege, and it's just been invaluable. And just hearing their stories without even having these direct conversations makes you realize what these different pockets of privilege and power that we and oppression that we live in are, without even being able to have, or without having to have, these institutionalized or formal discussions. Just having those friendships with them really opened my eyes to see what are the different lives that we've led, what are the different pathways that we've led because your skin color is different from mine, or because your people group has been treated different from mine in this country. And so I would say that beyond those formal spaces, that is one of the most valuable ways that we can learn.
I think one of the things that have to happen, it has to be intentional, not just to have conversation, but I think it has to be intentional for the door of transformation to be open. This is funny, but Gail said something earlier that sometimes, you know, you have one group just coming in because we need to talk. And believe me that as minorities in this country, it is almost like the culture of our homes. What happens in this house stays in this house. And it almost even across racial lines that sometimes there are conversations as an African-American, I don't want anybody of any other ethnicity to listen to. Like the pressure of just being like a minority is funny. Like even when a news story is coming on, this is a reality of being black in America. The news will say, five people were killed, and in the back of my mind as a black person, I'm going, please don't let him be black. 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 Please don't let him be a black dude. Dang, it's the black guy. And so now I got to walk around with the. And so sometimes there's an internal conversation of wanting to interact with people, not because of, not because I feel like I have to, but I want you to want, I want you to have the intention to want to know me because of me, and then allow it to be a more natural progression to understand my story. Not for an interview, not for a case study, not so you can have like the one black guy that you know that you can talk about, you know. No, just to know me as an individual. And then from there, I think with that level of trust, it allows for deeper intimacy. It's funny because as a part of the cohort, this is going to sound very corny, but the coolest white people I know are part of the cohort. Not because they're in the cohort, but because we've actually spent intentional time together, basically very transparent with one another. And I think when we're able to be honest with each other, it allows for relationships to develop at a greater level, at a deeper level, because we're just getting to know each other as human beings.
I'm just going to add one thing. Just so you know, I'm hella white. I'm very white. I have a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. I'm middle income. I live in a very safe community. My best friends are white. I'm very white. It's also one of the realities of how one has to assimilate, to be able to maintain one's ability to climb through the system. There are parts of my brown identity that I have had to, at times, intentionally shed in order to be able to be accepted in the crew. When you go to the University of California, Berkeley, which at that time was the number one school of education in the country, there was a whole part of my identity that I just had to keep below the radar so I could be one of the folks in the crew. And I had to talk a particular way, which meant that during my class time, I would hear particularly disparaging comments made about Latino families, made about Latinos in education. And I either became the angry Latino who like said, whoa, wait a minute. Or I had to be able to kind of like, all right, in order to be able to keep this grant, I just got to keep playing the game. And that's another tax that comes on us. And there are ways in which at the end of that system, in order to get out of a K-12 system, out of an MA, out of a PhD, into the academy, I've had to act white. or I don't get tenure, or I don't get asked to be on particular committees besides the race one, right? And so that when I raise that, because when we're often put up here, right, it's I'm going to be the brown person talking as the brown voice and the brown talking head, and I am. Trust me, I'm happy to do that, right? But also there are ways in which you're more black than I am, right, in terms of the work you're doing in East Oakland right now. I haven't been in East Oakland. That's where I used to teach kindergarten, right? It was like I had no problem going into East Oakland. That was fine. But it's also required a different way of engaging in the world. So when you look at us, don't see us just as white or Latino or whatever. Figure out how we've had to do those stories on the everyday ways to remain some sense. Now, it also causes schizophrenia, right? And so there are times when it's like, you heard some of my language when I'm down in East Salinas. It's not the way I talk here when I'm in First Press. And my East Salinas friends would look at me and laugh at me, right? There's a different way that I have to code switch when I work that way out.
Thank you. Hard answers. Heavy answers.
It's hard work. But it's beautiful work. Joy of talking through this stuff and working it out, and particularly in my vocation when I see teachers, white teachers, as the question was earlier, who quote get it and want to do that switch, when I interrogate my Latinas about their own ways in which Mexican culture and patriarchy has like erased some of their own identities, in which folks in which Spanish is their native language, and I've said, fine, you can write your essays in Spanish, I got no problem with that, and all the rest of my faculty are like, what did you just do to us? I said, yeah, I made you like live up to our vocation, right? And those kinds of things. That's when I think our work is incredibly beauty. That's when I see the resurrection, right? That's when I'm not just hit by the weight of the cross. That's when I get to believe that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead. And there's a possibility then of us being able to work into that space in which God is glorified. And not that I want to be egotistical, but I'm sure it's all open. Like, well done, good and faithful servant. And that well doneness was about this particular little thin slice of racial reconciliation in a country that needed it badly. That joyful part is powerful. Forget Coke, man. That joy is, I'm just joking.
We've gotten to cocaine jokes, so let's push forward. And actually, I want to get into an area that we haven't talked on yet. And there's a couple questions, and I apologize if this feels disrespectful. If this is your question, I'm going to combine them for the sake of time because I want to get into this. We haven't touched on the biracial conversation. How does that fit into this conversation that we're having? When it's not neat, when it's not an either or.
Biracial or interracial?
Let me read a couple of questions. What are your observations regarding how people who are biracial and or multiracial fit into the race, privilege, oppression situation? First question. So I want to read the second question. I am racially mixed with a partially African-American background, but don't necessarily look it. I've been taught that I'm lucky to be able to avoid racism. How can I give up the privilege that I'm told to hold on to?
So those of you know who my children, right? You know Leslie and you know Jeffrey. Back when Sylvia, my wife, gave birth to Leslie, you could only check off one box. And so Sylvia, being the mom, we gave her the choice. So Leslie is Asian. But the deal was, if we had a second child, I got to choose. So my daughter is Asian, and my son is Latino-Hispanic. Now, if you know anything, right, in the 2010 census, Latino was taken out, so I no longer have a race, as does my son, right? That's now a cultural ethnic group under something else. I can put Leslie in a group of Asians, she looks really Asian. I can put Leslie in a group of Latinas, she looks really Latina. I can even sometimes put Leslie in a group of whites and she can look white. And especially with her platinum blonde hair now. When she's got blue hair and green hair and purple hair, it shifts. I say that because, right, as Du Bois argues, right, there's this double consciousness, right, where she has a racial representation that whether she wants to or not, people are going to racialize her in a particular way. And so it's meant that she and I have had to have a lot of conversations about how people are going to see her. Conversely, as Du Bois argues, right, she gets to choose who she wants to be, right? So she's a feminist Chicana lesbian. Boom. And so when she writes her papers, that's the identity out of she comes out of. When she works out her politics and the people in terms of who she's going to cite, she's a senior at Cal, it comes out of that lens. And that's an appropriated identity, right? No disrespect to her mom, but it's where Leslie has come to feel a sense of home. Now, if you know Jeffrey, he's like a little me. Like, looks like me, and he's like not going to be able to pass into any other racial group. So recently when he went off to Las Vegas to go to a gaming conference, I had to say, you're going with five other white guys. Just don't do anything stupid. If you ever get pulled over in your Uber car, I just need you to be smart. And so when I had to have the, quote, talk with my son about his racial identity, it wasn't about being biracial. It was about how he would be perceived irrespective of the intersection of race and culture and his own sense of identity, which for those of us who live in the Bay is a nice little bubble to live in, right? Because being Hapa is kind of more the norm than not being Hapa. And that's a great gift that I feel like I turned down a job at the University of Wisconsin in Madison because I couldn't imagine a Chinese American wife and two Hapa kids in a, basically a black-white city. And I said, I can't do that to you. I don't think that's fair. It's a great job for me, but I just think it would be tough for you. And so I say that in the terms of not only is there decisions for the biracial kids, but I think there's decisions for the rest of us in the community to go back to that larger argument of how do we, not just as parents, but you all as community folk, right? I'm looking at some folks in this room who've known my kids since they were born and have been incredible instruments of love and justice in my children's lives. Not simply because they're biracial, but because they're people of faith, because they're people who are made in the image of God. And that has to somehow come back into that challenge of one of the identities that biracial folks hold is, how do we see them as children of God?
That was wonderful. I don't have a great answer for this, so I'm going to not make something up to sound smart, but I'm going to pass on.
Yeah, me too.
Oh my God. The burden. Oh my God. I find it hilarious that you say you turned a job down a job. I have a brother-in-law who actually left the very same institution. And he actually is in an interracial marriage, has two biracial children. So my brother, this is so funny. He is, he's a history professor. He is now teaching at the University of Iowa. Don't tell me why he did that. Yeah, so much easier than Madison, Wisconsin. So Richard is what I would consider to be on the darker end of actually being black. His wife, Deborah, is actually from South Africa, who, you know, who is actually white. They have two children. They have a son named Bevan and a daughter named Lindell. And they basically are two of the sweetest kids you can ever meet. And the conversations are always hilarious about them out in public with their children. Richard remembers going to the mall and walking with the kids, and really there's no reaction. But when Deb, who is white, is with her children, they're looking as, who do those kids belong to? And so I think there's always this immense pressure and weight on biracial children of which side do you downplay? Like, you always live with the opportunity to choose sides. And I can say that for, it has to be because you don't want to disrespect any part of your heritage, but sometimes to be able to have the choice how you want to identify can be very difficult. And that has to be internally difficult
for children who also live under the reality that the that their parents are looked at in a different way. So it's not only carrying the ire of carrying two different heritages, but also that people question why even your parents even connected in the first place. So there has to be something of difficulty. There is another part of this, kind of going to this, is kind of, I have an uncle who is one of the first three African-Americans to pass the state of Louisiana. It's kind of hard to talk about this because the first time he is so light complex, they didn't realize that he was African-American until a little bit later. And so he was at the first time he passed the bar. He could not receive any credentials that he couldn't practice law in the state of Louisiana. So he spent a year in court fighting. He got with him, and they, all three of them, ended up passing the bar together. But he mentioned something to my mom, and this is a story that is very prevalent in our family, that the only time the weight of being part white you is when you have the other part of being black in the background, is that they accepted him. They didn't accept him whole. A part of him was insignificant because of the and the color of his skin. So there's a weight and a pressure that I think those as one race, we would never really adequately know how heavy that weight is.
I'll just add this for the second half, which was how do folks who can pass give up that privilege? And this is gonna shift, the black-white binary. Within the Mexicano community, I'll just speak from that, but I know it exists also in the African-American community, right? We make distinctions between the negritas and the güeras, the light-skinned and the dark-skinned. And our community is full of that kind of discourse. And one are more loved than the other. And yet it's used in a very kind of jovial kind of way. And yet our children grow up with a great sense of shame and uncertainty because of the discourse that we use. Just speaking of the Latino community, the Mexican community, Mexico, I'm now speaking of that part south of the technical border, we have a long history of anti-black discrimination. Slavery just wasn't, you know, north of the border. If you're indígena in Mexico, very bad thing. So that we wrestle as brown folk with our own sense of racism. Thank you very much, white folk. We don't need it. We're doing quite well, right? And I raise that not just in a sarcastic sense, but in a sense in which the trauma of colonialism, the trauma of racism, the trauma of patriarchy has found its way very deeply into Mexican culture. And I'm just using that as an example. I can speak about Peru, I can speak about Guatemala, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's something that we have to wrestle with simultaneously. And in some ways, right, when we were talking earlier about that sense in which kind of, would you all just go in your room and figure that stuff out and then come talk to us? We got to sit down in our own room and talk about this stuff as well before we even figure out, well, what's the racism? Go down to some of the communities that I'm working with in Greenfield, Gonzales, the southern part of Monterey County. The discrimination against the Triqui, against the Mixteca who come from Oaxaca, right? And I kid my Mexican brown folks, like, you're worried about white on brown racism? Look at the racism that you're doing brown on brown. And we got to figure that out. So the fall and the deep nature of sin is quite great. No one racial community has a good priority handle on that.
Thank you once again. I'm going to try and keep us on our 9 o'clock schedule and just ask two more questions. Second to last one is coming from the audience. Assuming that reality in North America will no longer permit us to refer to society as Christian, what's the posture and or purpose of church in North America regarding state-enabled racial injustice, particularly when Sunday worship is the most segregated hour of the week? Did you catch that? Do you want me to reread it? You catch it? Yeah, I'll repeat it one more time coming at you. Assuming that the reality in North America will no longer permit us to refer to society as Christian, what's the posture and or purpose of the church in North America regarding state-enabled racial injustice?
I think this is how I understand the question. Help me out if I'm totally whoever asked the question responded. Last I checked, Jesus was probably not blonde and blue-eyed. Dang! And there's no Easter Bunny. Palestinian. And I don't want to get into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's another dialogue that should take place there as part of one of these series. But I raise that because I think that one of the realities that we have is that I'm going to try and make this three-step argument, so work with me here, folks, for a second, that the church has codified a particular flavor of Jesus. And if you go back to Ben McBride's series that he did with us, if you remember, there was that one where he wanted to go, here's the 18 different racial and cultural varieties of a Jesus, right? And so I think on the one hand, we have that reality that is established there, that whether we like it or not, Jesus is basically blonde and blue-eyed. And when we put next to that the institution of American democracy, right, and that we have 43 presidents, 44 now, 43 of them white. So we won't even get into the gender one argument yet, right? And so this mythology that we tell all of our children that you can grow up to be president, the evidence is overwhelming to the contrary. Don't buy the lie. The evidence is overwhelming to the contrary. So when I put those two arguments together, then I'm reminded of Jesus and this whole notion, particularly that came out of the 60s, of the notion of the counterculture. Or I think about the very real notion of liberation theology, of speaking from the margins, right? That there is a prophetic role, right? Whether we're talking about scripture from Micah, whether we're talking about a variety of folks that speak in all the way up, including Jesus and past Jesus, right? I think one of the things when we look back at King, right, a prophetic voice, literally voice, but also about the message. I think the church has amazing responsibility to speak up and out against injustice of a variety of flavors, particularly race and racism. And I think if we took seriously at a much deeper level this election, right, and part of I think our challenge is it's just so humorous and sad that we're not taking it as seriously as we knew, to really be understanding the ways in which we're recodifying language, the ways in which we're recodifying outright racism. And we're okay with that to a large extent, not here in our nice little bubble in the East Bay, but across this nation, right? That's gonna have major implications for communities of color, whether he wins or not. We have allowed the discourse to shift. I'm not certain this church, this particular one, 2407 Dana, in this particular place, has spoken into that silence in the way that I would hope it would in terms of being able to challenge that kind of discourse and what it means for us as a community of faith. And I'll use for an example, and I'm not trying to pull up a bunch of old wounds for us. If you look back at gender, sexuality, marriage, and leadership, I can count on my hand the number of times the word gay or lesbian was used from the pulpit. But I can't count the number of times we used coded language to say the same thing, the issues the Presbyterian Church is wrestling with, right? I don't think we say the same thing about racism and call it what it is. And so if the church is going to be prophetic, it's going to have to call some things out. And it's going to have to call some things out both within this room as people of faith, and it's going to have to call out some things outside of this room to the larger society that wants to claim we're a Christian nation. Fine, let's claim we're a Christian nation. Then we got to do some work there if we're going to do that. I'm not advocating that necessarily. I'm just saying that if we're going to be consistent, we got to be consistent. Yeah. I hope I got the question right. Okay.
So I think as we think about the church not having the same kind of power, the same kind of respected influence as it used to, that might be happening, and you could say is happening, but we can still have a prophetic voice to live a different kind of story. to live by a different kind of system, a different kind of reality in the way of Jesus than what is happening, you know, in the world. So I think we can live into a different kind of reality as the church, even if we don't have that same kind of, you know, political power or whatever it is. John Perkins, he's the founder of the CCDA, older African-American gentleman who I just think is amazing. But he still says, listen, the church is the greatest hope we have for racial reconciliation. That's one of his mantras, that the church is the greatest hope we have because we have this story of Jesus. We have this story of unearned grace, of unearned privilege. And we have to rise up to be this hope. We can live this alternate reality. So I'll say that's one answer A for me. Other answer is, you know, I spent a lot of time reading kind of missiology, Christians, you know, for the last several years, Christian theology books and the future of the church kind of books and emerging church kind of books years and years ago. And when I moved to Oakland, I was actually really intrigued about 10 years ago that the church does have a loud voice still, and I'd be interested if you disagree with me, but the church has a loud voice, at least in Oakland. Clergy, black and Latino clergy, have a seat at the table. And I think a lot of the influence I've, or the tables I've been, is because I know clergy, and I've gotten to the table because of that, through OCO, you know, groups of clergy who are doing a lot of the important work for justice, I mean, at the table with some of the power players. So I think in some realms we can write off the church's influence too quickly, when in some cities we still have a seat at the table to do a lot of good work with.
Yeah, I would echo that. I don't think it's a bad thing that the church is losing a political power. I think deinstitutionalizing is always the way to go. and to add to that, I lost my train of thought. what was I going to say? I'm totally blanked. But let's see. Can you repeat the question? Because I think that would help me bring it back.
The question was asking about what posture ought we to take as the church in North America regarding state-enabled racial injustice?
Okay, right. This is not really directly answering the question, but as somebody who grew up in a Korean church, I've thought a lot about what it means that we are deeply segregated on Sunday morning. And I, at least for now, have come to the conclusion that that's okay, because Christianity, especially in this country, has been appropriated by Western Christianity, and I think there's definitely something beautiful about the fact that there's these more intersectional churches that exist here, and there's safety and God works in those different types of communities. And it's not necessarily our goal as a Big C church is to push God's agenda forward. And I don't know if being integrated necessarily will do that. I think there's gifts and talents and mission that grows from all of those different spaces. So that's kind of where I am now. I'm not sure what I'll think a year from now. But I do think when there are multi-ethnic spaces like First Press, that's a different question, right? Like, I really appreciate that these conversations are happening. When I tell my friends who are in my department who are not Christian that we've had conversations like this and even GSML, they are utterly shocked, especially because I am alone in sociology as a Christian. Mentioned earlier, and the fact that they still even interact with me and want to have a relationship with me and hear my story is because they know that I come from a church like this that is not afraid to have these conversations and that these different, and I'm not trying to say this to inflate my own sense of self, but they somehow see a different kind of Christian in me, and I feel like that's really where the power is, and not... though the church is slowly dying as an institution, I'm not sure if that is actually a bad thing. Yeah.
I think we must do a comparison and a contrast of the American church and the kingdom of God. Because to only think about our national identity when it comes to the kingdom of God actually short circuits the power of the church locally, nationally, and then internationally. I'll give you a perfect example. I am a member of a Church of God, which is based in Anderson, Indiana. And inside of the Church of God, there is also another organization, which is still the Church of God, called the National Association of the Church of God, which is based in West Middlesex, Pennsylvania. This past year, they just celebrated their 100th anniversary of primarily being the African-American arm of the Church of God. There is a stark reality that I think sometimes we forget about our churches is that you don't have mixed churches where there are no mix of people. So I think the reality of our churches always being divided amongst racial lines does not change because of geography. So you primarily have churches that are intentionally mixed culturally, only where there has been people groups who have moved there for specific reasons. So you have heavy African-American population on the West Coast, in Seattle, you have them in Long Beach, you have them in Oakland, in the Los Angeles area, in Vallejo, only because it was a place where people moved in the 40s and the 50s seeking a new new ways of employment or even through military affiliation. So one wouldn't put the pressure on us to worry about churches coming together across racial lines being in one house of worship. That's a reality. Secondly, I think there is a need for us to be honest that we have to be careful of deifying our nation. That our Americanism can't be traded for our kingdom citizenship. That because I live here does not make me a better Christian than someone else across the world. And so somehow, some way, this American imperialism has a way of mixing in with our relationship with God. And therefore, we have this American Christian superiority complex, which basically makes our entire relationship with other Christians complex. Because if I mix my nationality with my Christianity, I'm going to automatically inherit those biases and those advantages that come with identifying as being American, which is primarily saying identify as being white. And so that excludes some people groups. And I would even go as far to say, it's funny, in our church now, we're having this conversation about black presence in the Bible. Because there are conversations within the African-American community because of racial strife, where you have specific groups like the Nation of Islam, who use the issue of privilege and of racism of a reason not to be Christian. Because the argument is, you didn't know who Christ was, there's no such thing as Christianity until you became a slave. And therefore, as a person of African descent, I got to say, nah, because the Jesus of the scriptures and everything that happened in the Bible prior to Paul's missionary journey all happens in Africa. So I have to now fight against this attack on my identity as a Christian that this is something inherited to me because of slavery and somehow racism. So I have to fight against that narrative. But then the problem is that conversation becomes very uncomfortable. And who does Jesus really look like? And if it's not important that Jesus is not white, why is it important that he is white? And these are real conversations. Look, I went to Dallas Baptist University, and this is probably for the first time in my life, I was a minority in the group. There's 3% African-Americans, 97% Caucasian, period. And I remember having the conversation, and this is probably the worst time of my life. It was 2007. Barack Obama was running for president. And I became the resident expert on, did you hear the Jeremiah Wright sermon? And so that became a reality for me that there, within the body of Christ, there is this tension, even within race. Because when nation invades our kingdom mentality, we are not the kingdom of God. We are the kingdom of America trying to please God. And it inhibits us from actually being the kingdom of God, which allows us to overcome the racial divide. I would say if we look at John, the fourth chapter, it's probably one of the greatest examples of overcoming religious splits, racial and cultural splits. Every time the woman at the well tried to bring up a reason why Jesus should not talk to her, he found a way to navigate around all of her hurdles. And at the end of the conversation, he offered her an opportunity at new life, not because, you know, of her identity as a woman, not because she was a Samaritan, but because she was a human being in need of salvation. And so when we learn how to put aside all those other things and the pressure from our groups to not to talk to that group, because Jesus is like, what are you talking to her for? When we learn to put those things aside, we become the kingdom of God, and we don't have to worry about these other things that prevent the church from not having power, because as the kingdom of God, we have all power because we have access to an all-powerful God.
Thank you, thank you. And I just want to say, here is where I would normally apologize for going over and excuse everyone, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask one last question. And I will just ask, because we've gone over, out of respect for everyone, if we can keep it short, maybe. We're really good at having conversations at First Press. How do we stop perpetuating the conversation mode as if we can tick off the race privilege box now and go about business as normal? What's a good next step for those who have come out to tonight's conversation, assuming that everyone taking the time on a Sunday evening cares deeply about these issues? Where do we go from here? What's something we can do, practically speaking? What's a good next step?
We've already kind of talked about this, and I've given mine, so I know what I want to say. I just forget all the rest of you. We should just think about K-12 education. And then we should think about school programs, and then we should think about education and higher education, and then we should think about interfaith. And I was serious when I said this. I think that we need to look for domains in which you feel a sense of calling, in which you feel like you want to do something, and that we should then be not waiting for Bridget and Ryan to kind of say, we'll plan something for you, but we should be coming together as the body of Christ, as people who have been called in some way to think about something. For me, that's K-12 education and higher education, right? And that's where I feel like I'm uniquely gifted, in which if there's some other folks that want to do that work, great, let's do that work. I was also saying, in terms of where we are with Faith Network, we're at this point in which we're celebrating 15 years. Let's use that as a moment to really stop and ponder. What has the 15 years brought us? Where are we moving in the next 15 years? How do we set a vision for doing that? And Bridget and I have had some conversations. She's got a child, and what does that mean 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now when she thinks about what does it mean? And I would even argue, as I'm looking, you know, at folks in the back who have kids who are ready to leave high school and everything like that, it doesn't mean we're still not out of the system, right? We pay taxes. We're thinking about the next generation that is bigger than just us. That's the community, and I think how we will go about actually putting down roots in that kind of a particular domain is a domain in which we could make a great kind of impact. And then we'll go play basketball.
Yes, yeah. So I'm stealing this from PICO, Faith Organizing Network, straight up, so you can't have it, Demetrius. But if they break it down, the body, the ballot, and the buck. So our bodies. If there is a walk or an organizing meeting about this or a protest or a something, can we take our body there? Even if we don't know what's going on completely, but we think we should go check it out, can we take our body there and go learn? So your body, the ballot, there is voting coming up, and the reality is that a lot of the things on the ballot locally will affect real people and will affect people of color in some of these discussions. When we're talking about our prison system, I mean, these things will affect people of color sometimes more than a white person who might be voting for it. So please look at the ballot, study the ballot. There's plenty of research out there to help you, but take this voting seriously and invite your friends to vote with you on some of these things. And the buck, where are we spending our money? Are the companies we support involved in private prison industry, enslaving black and brown people, to where do we go to eat? Do we support businesses who are only white, or do we make an effort to say, how do I take my money and support people who are different than me? And that can actually make a real difference. So the body, the ballot, and the buck.
It works.
It's very hard. It's hard to be in here, just surrounded by all these amazing people. But to add to that, I would say one thing I'm trying to do is really just examine my relationships and my social world on a regular basis. Who do I interact with? Who do I feel safe with? Who do I feel unsafe with, and why? And try to kind of push those boundaries for myself. And so I think just beyond the amazing conversations and dialogue that we're having here, that's just something that I would want to encourage all of us to do, is examine who our friends are and our social circles. Who do we feel comfortable going up to? Who do we ignore? Who do we dismiss? And try to do something different about that. I think another thing that I do want to speak to is just the idea of intersectional identities. I think we touched upon that already, but race is huge, Black lives, huge. But I think it's also important, kind of going along the lines of that, the question of a biracial identity, I think just we all know that we have very complex identities. So is there a way to go beyond seeing someone as, okay, you're Asian, I'm going to go talk to you because I don't have any Asian friends, but just, you are also a member of this church. You are also a sister or brother in Christ. We're all in the kingdom of God. Let's not have an exclusive mentality, but be able to extend that love and that grace to just whoever is around us. I feel like that is something I'm just trying to be more mindful of, and I'd love for us all to have that attitude.
Since Nate stole that good answer of the body ballot in the book. No, in all seriousness, I think it comes down to praying, asking where could you make a difference? Because everyone's response can't be the same. It can't be something you just pull out of a bag or a can. But I think it's something that you can begin to pray about. And when I say pray, have a prayer like Peter. And I think there's something I can insert. This is a little bit of humor. Is that as Peter has his vision and he's battling in his mind over what's clean and unclean, the Lord says to him, nothing I've made is unclean. And a lot of times people approach that scripture from dietary restrictions. I think the Lord was speaking larger than Peter's stomach. I think you don't have to be afraid of getting involved with another people group. They aren't going to harm you. They aren't going to hurt you. I think it takes time to pray and then find intentional ways of doing small things. Having a conversation maybe with one person that leads into you maybe spending some intentional time with that person, understanding who they are and where they're from, and then helping, and then maybe even crafting something that you can do together. I believe it's easier to do something within our homes. It's something we can do within our own family. And it doesn't always have to be an opportunity. I think one of the things I want to encourage you don't have to wait on the church. Look around you. Ask the Lord to open your eyes, to show you where there is an opportunity. And then after you see the opportunity, serve the opportunity. Whether it be in a local school, whether there's a child who's neglected, find ways to be intentional about creating opportunities to be with others is something I think we can all do.
Thank you once again. One thing that you actually said in conversation, Miguel, that was helpful for me just in terms of getting ready for tonight was that you tend to think of three rules for these sorts of conversations. Take a chance, get messy, make mistakes.
The Fritz, it's not me.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking everyone a part of our panel. So at this point, Yeah, at this point, we are wrapped up. Sorry for keeping you late. Really do apologize about that. If you'd like to speak more with our panelists, maybe they'll be generous enough to... That's right. Context, context, context. Yeah.